The coals of the little cook fire glowed white hot in the dark night, illuminating a lump of clothing that had been left on the ground, abandoned by its previous owner. Crixus picked it up, a red cloak, the garb of a Roman soldier, who was now either dead somewhere in the remains of this camp or off running for his life. The woolen fabric served nicely as a rag to clean the blood from the edge of Crixus's curved sword. Perhaps, he thought, some of that blood belonged to the man who had been wearing the cloak up until a few minutes ago. Crixus and the other former slaves had fallen on the camp during the blackest part of the night. The moon peeked out only occasionally behind rolling veils of clouds, and few stars shone through. That helped give them the element of surprise. The Romans' utter disbelief that a band of fugitives could do them any harm helped them even more. Crixus knew the Romans. He knew how they operated and what they thought about people, slaves, like him. Not like him, he corrected himself. Crixus was a slave no longer. Not since the day he, the Thracian Spartacus, and 70 others escaped from the gladiatorial school near Capua, where they'd been imprisoned. He would never be a slave again. Death was preferable to the monotony of life in the Ludus, with its frequent stings of the lash and the pain of the blade cutting his flesh. He had spent years fighting for the adulation of the crowd and the wealth of his master. Now, Crixus fought for his own freedom. The skills he'd learned in the arena served him well in battle. His body certainly remembered every single one. Cut and thrust, block and parry, sidestep and strike. He would never forget them, could never forget them. Not after all the countless hours of training he'd been subjected to, the copious sweat and blood spilled in the process. Crixus had been a fine gladiator and received his fair share of ovations, but he considered this new work a far better use of his skills. It was certainly a better use of his time. What else would he do? Herd sheep? The thought was absurd. It had been years since the concept of death bothered Crixus. A frisson of awareness of his own mortality came to him during this last fight, when the point of a Roman dagger slid along his cheek, leaving a thin, deep cut. Nevertheless, he was determined to live without any fear of death, especially in battle. Far better to die free, sword in hand, than nailed to a cross or on the sands of the arena. I'm Patrick Wyman. Welcome to Past Lives. Enslaved people did not become so willingly. From the moment they were taken to the moment they died, in ways both large and small, they resisted. Prisoners taken from battlefields and sacked cities might commit suicide rather than be forced into captivity, a last act of human defiance in the face of an inhumane fate. From ancient Athens to 19th century South Carolina, enslaved people found ways to flout their circumstances, frustrate their masters, and maintain some semblance of human dignity. Masters who complained constantly about their slaves being too lazy or stupid to do what they were told were ignorant of the reality, which was that enslaved people knew how to use their masters' unearned sense of superiority and their ignorance of the work itself against them. They saw no reason to work quickly or do anything more than the bare minimum necessary to avoid retaliation. These were the techniques the anthropologist James Scott famously called the weapons of the weak. To wield these weapons, plausible deniability was essential. If they weren't careful enough or edged into outright disobedience, then violent punishment was the inevitable result. Considering the awful conditions under which so many enslaved people experienced life over the millennia, the fact that there weren't more large-scale rebellions does come as a surprise. When faced with conditions that oscillated between unpleasant and outright lethal, actively fighting against one's oppressors would seem like a logical choice. Yet that observation fails to account for the care masters took in controlling their human property. Slave owners were fundamentally aware of the fact that enslaved people did not want to be enslaved, and treated them accordingly. Close surveillance, the use of ropes and chains, and locking the enslaved in their quarters overnight were all standard management techniques. Other, less overt forms of control were often used, although they were no less violent. Masters might threaten to break up a troublesome slave's family by selling one or more of its members, or they could reassign them to a particularly degrading or dangerous task. It was violence that kept enslaved people trapped in their circumstances. Violence experienced in the past, violence witnessed in the present, and violence promised in the future. If we want to understand why enslaved people didn't rebel more often, the primary reason lies in the continuous application of vicious, excessive force. This makes the fact that on some rare occasions slaves did rebel, sometimes on an extraordinarily large scale, all the more remarkable. Between 1791 and 1804, enslaved Haitians overthrew the sugar-planting elite and fought off French attempts to regain control of their native island in one of the only truly successful revolts in history. In the early years of the Protestant Reformation, downtrodden German peasants dreamt of a better world, and 100,000 of them would die for that dream when their lords retaliated. But the most famous revolt of all took place in the Roman world. It was led by a man whose legend survives to this day, told and retold in numerous books, movies, and TV shows. Spartacus. For 2 years, between 73 and 71 BC, tens of thousands of formerly enslaved people lived free in Italy, until the combined might of the Roman Republic and two of its most brilliant generals brought them back down to heel. Thousands of victims were captured and crucified along the road from Rome to Capua, where Spartacus's rebellion began. Their bodies may be dust, but their actions have never been forgotten. I mention Spartacus because in today's episode, we'll be focusing not on the legend himself, but on Crixus, one of his lieutenants. We know only a few hard facts about Crixus. He was a Gaul. He had been among the gladiators who escaped the training school, the Ludus, in Capua, and he died commanding a portion of the rebel army before Spartacus and the others met their end. We have far more knowledge about the world in which Crixus lived and rebelled, which means the picture we draw of him in this episode will be informed by the events through which he lived, if not the exact events of his life. But he will be our guiding light through this episode as we try to understand one of the most indelible events in ancient history. Before we can get into the rebellion and Crixus himself, however, we need to acquaint ourselves with Roman Italy in the 70s BC, the world of Roman slavery, and the life of a gladiator. The Roman world in Crixus's time looked far different than it had in Terence's nearly a century before. The process of Mediterranean conquest was over. Carthage had been destroyed, Roman officials governed territories from Iberia to Sicily to Western Asia, and Rome itself had ballooned to just shy of 1 million inhabitants, the largest city in the world. But the Republic was not well. 2 decades before the Spartacus Rebellion, in 91 BC, a massive revolt of Rome's Italian allies rocked the very foundations of the state. Formerly reliable friends who were fed up with the arrogant Roman elite who ran the Republic and frustrated by the uneven dispersals of the enormous spoils of empire spent 4 years battling it out for a better deal. In the end, they mostly got it. Full Roman citizenship was extended widely throughout Italy, and the division between citizens and allies that had defined the Republic for 300 years came to an end. But the social war was just the beginning of Rome's problems. The roots of them lay within the senatorial aristocracy that governed the city, the blue-blooded officials who competed with one another for elected offices, prestige, and plunder from military campaigns and governorships. Political murder, unthinkable within the Roman system for centuries, reappeared with a vengeance. The reforming brothers Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus were both assassinated by political opponents within the Senate in 133 and 121 BC, respectively, after they attempted to introduce major land reforms. As the aristocrats got richer, the story goes, they used their vast wealth to buy up the farms of poor Roman citizens. Then they turned those farms into huge plantations called latifundia, employing dozens or even hundreds of enslaved laborers to work the land, usually in awful conditions. The Gracchi brothers intended to place limits on landholding by the richest Romans and redistribute the excess land to poor Roman citizens. These reforms were fairly mild, all things considered, but the Roman aristocracy responded with overwhelming violence. When I say assassinated, I mean that senators and their supporters beat Tiberius Gracchus to death with whatever blunt objects were at hand, killed Gaius or forced him to commit suicide, and then executed anyone they could get their hands on. This kind of violence carried over into the social war a few decades later, and then with still greater force during the civil wars between Marius and Sulla that threatened to rip apart the Roman state in the 80s and 70s BC. All of this was just wrapping up in the years prior to Spartacus's rebellion. The issue of land, who owned it and how it was worked, is an important one in Crixus's case because it's directly tied to the Spartacus rebellion. The story about rich Romans dispossessing the poor and turning their small farms into huge plantations isn't borne out by the evidence. Italy was as full of small farmers in the 70s BC as it had been a century or even 2 centuries before. What were real, however, were the latifundia that poured safe wealth into the pockets of Rome's already wealthy elite. Scholars argue about how many slaves there were in Italy at this time and what percentage of the population they comprised. Safe estimates are 1 to 1.5 million enslaved people, making up 20 to 25% of the population. Latifundia and the slaves working them were particularly dense in southern Italy and Sicily. Chain gangs worked the fields and vineyards, enslaved drovers ran huge herds of cattle, and enslaved shepherds maintained the vast flocks of sheep whose wool clothed the Roman public. That meant there were dozens, even hundreds, of brutalized workers on each individual plantation living out in the countryside, and dozens of plantations crammed into a single province. Sicily, for example, had hundreds of thousands of enslaved workers by the 130s BC, when the first major slave revolt in Roman history erupted. This was the First Servile War. In the 3 years it took to suppress it, tens of thousands of rebels across Sicily were killed, executed, or crucified en masse as a warning to others. The Romans learned nothing from this incident, and a second servile war broke out in Sicily 30 years later. It too took several years to end, lasting from 104 to 100 BC. And like the first, it cost thousands upon thousands of lives. Now, I've studied a lot of different elite groups over my years doing history, and I honestly think the equestrians and senators of the late Republic placed first for collective and individual wealth. These men were orders of magnitude richer than their grandfathers had been, who had in turn been orders of magnitude richer than their grandfathers. Each aristocratic family was basically the equivalent of a large, diversified, multinational corporation. They owned latifundia, smaller commercial farms, tasteful rural villas, lavish vacation homes on the Bay of Naples, herds of cattle and flocks of sheep, manufacturing facilities for pottery, and merchant shipping concerns. The equestrians, who weren't active in political life, lacked the senatorial aristocracy's aversion to the grubby business of money-making, and were often even wealthier and more diversified than their social and political superiors. All of these businesses were effectively run by slaves on behalf of their owners, from the lowliest field hand or shepherd up to the banking specialists, secretaries, managers, and advisors who often lived better than free Romans. Many of those at the bottom of enslaved life had little or no contact with any free people, much less their distant owners. Roman citizens, for their part, had no illusions about their dependence on their slaves and the potential danger those vast numbers of brutalized people could pose. The orator Cicero tells us that the Roman aristocrat Domitius, governing Sicily after the Second Servile War, marveled at the size of a wild boar that had been hunted and killed. When he found out a slave had killed the boar, and the slave told the governor that he had used a spear for the deed, Domitius ordered the man to be crucified. Cicero says, quote, "Domitius preferred cruelty and punishment rather than to seem lax by overlooking a crime." These were the foundations of Spartacus's rebellion. Italy was simmering with discontent. The Italian allies, recently remade as citizens, hadn't forgotten the bloody repression of their bid for better status. Two massive slave rebellions had left Roman owners fully aware of the risk presented by hundreds of thousands of enslaved people who were now mostly unsupervised and isolated among themselves. Anecdotally, in my opinion, the Roman approach to slavery was never more brutal than at this time. The fabric of the Roman state had nearly ripped itself to pieces. The time was ripe for the Italian countryside to once again explode in unrest and violence. We know only three things about Crixus. He was a Gaul, he had been a gladiator at the same school as Spartacus, and he went on to lead a portion of the rebel army, dying in battle about a year before Spartacus himself famously met his end. Still, that's enough for us to reconstruct a relief map of Crixus's world, a starting point for the experiences that defined his life. When our sources refer to Crixus as a Gaul, his name means curly-haired in the Gaulish language, so it's basically like calling him Curly, that's a pretty broad designation. Gaul was an ethnic category that referred to people born everywhere from the Pyrenees to the North Sea to the Hungarian plain. We sometimes call these people Celts. They're the same term, with Gaul coming from Latin and Celt from Greek. There were Gauls living in what we now think of as Italy. The region between the Po River and the Alps was Cisalpine Gaul, though by Crixus's time, Gauls were more likely to be found on the far side of the Great Mountains. Gauls could find their way to Roman slave markets through both military campaigning and the more routine slave trade that exchanged wine and fine pottery for human beings at ports like Massilia, today's Marseille. That's one possible origin story for Crixus. Taken from his home in Gaul, then forced on a long walk or boat trip down the Rhone, followed by either a short sail along the coast to Italy or a chained march along the French Riviera. Alternatively, he might have been hustled through the Alps from what's now Switzerland or Austria, shivering in the cold as he trudged over well-worn passes. He might even have been born to Gaulish parents in Italy. We simply don't know. What's certain is that Crixus must have cut an imposing figure on the auction block, stripped down to a loincloth and presented for sale, degraded and dehumanized into a commodity. We know this because he ended up at a gladiatorial school owned by Gnaeus Cornelius Lentulus Vatia, sometimes called Vatiatus. The fact that one could be a trainer of gladiators by occupation and own a school dedicated to the craft gives some sense of the scale of the industry at this time. The Roman public were increasingly becoming connoisseurs of violence, with specific tastes in the bloodletting they packed into temporary arenas and stone amphitheaters to watch, while ambitious men footed the bill for the entertainment. While we tend to think of gladiatorial games as to-the-death free-for-alls, that wasn't actually the case. There were match officials and rules, like keeping one's distance from a wounded opponent, and the editor, sponsor, of the games always determined whether the loser would survive. The gravestones of gladiators often indicate that they lost on numerous occasions, so losing a match wasn't the death sentence Hollywood may have led us to believe. The content of the games varied as well. Fights between wild beasts or between people and beasts were always a favorite. Gladiators could always be called upon to serve as entertaining executioners of war captives or criminals. Lowbrow gladiatorial entertainment might involve a few hundred people crowded into an open marketplace to watch a starving bear tear apart a few condemned criminals. At the highest end, a would-be consul might empty his cash reserves to hire dozens of pairs of the best-trained gladiators in Italy for a production that would ensure the crowd never forgot its benefactor. In either case, the message to the viewers in the stands was always the same. No matter how far a Roman citizen might fall, no matter how destitute his financial situation or reputation, he would never be subjected to the humiliation of a public death. For a Roman, there was nothing more shameful, nothing more indicative of slave status than dying in full sight of a jeering crowd. Naturally, savvy entrepreneurs saw endless opportunity in this bloody marketplace. By the time Crixus was fighting in the arena, the industry was highly developed. Entrepreneurs like Gnaeus Cornelius Lentulus Vatia were operating at a substantial scale. Vatia had some 200 gladiators at his ludus, or gladiatorial school. The 60 pairs of gladiators hired for the funeral games of Publius Licinius Crassus in 183 BC, a previously unheard-of spectacle, would have seemed like a quaint offering for an elite Roman of Crixus's time. By then, gladiators were everywhere in Roman life, serving as bodyguards for the wealthy, instructors in arms for the legions, thugs for hire when politicians needed muscle, and a constant source of anxiety among Roman civilians, who were keenly aware of the dangers gladiators posed. These were brutalized men forced to brutalize others, outsiders enmeshed with Roman society, and they were stewing. Archaeological investigations of Pompeii have unearthed gladiatorial schools just like Vatia's. They were essentially fortified prisons designed to keep their occupants inside, away from polite Roman society. Guards watched the doors, bars and gates blocked potential exits, and punishments, lashings by the trainer, beatings for poor conduct or performance, and solitary confinement kept the enslaved fighters in line. Crixus and his comrades were a motley group, barbarians and outcasts from all over the Roman world and beyond, a mixture of Gauls, Thracians, Germans, and even down-on-their-luck Romans. They weren't an army, and they weren't soldiers, but they were all highly skilled warriors. They lifted heavy objects, wrestled and boxed, and practiced at length wooden swords to train and strengthen their bodies. They treated injuries and wounds after fights and did it all over again the next day. This was Crixus's life: training, eating, fighting in front of thousands of people, and then returning to the ludus where the gates would be locked behind him. Crixus and the others must have felt that they had no chance of a better life, no shot at freedom, or even a daily routine that didn't consist of endless violence. That may have been why, at some point in 73 BC, something snapped inside the house of Gnaeus Cornelius Lentulus Vatia. Crixus and his compatriots could no longer take it, and dozens of them decided together to break out. They did this despite knowing the likely consequences of their actions. Individual slaves ran away all the time, and those who returned of their own volition might get away with a beating or a tattooing or a branding. Mass escape was a much more serious issue, and it became even more serious when it boiled over into full-scale rebellion. The usual penalty for that was crucifixion, perhaps the most horrible way to die in the ancient world, and that only came after a period of the most extreme torture. Crixus, Spartacus, and the rest must have known this. The fact that they went ahead with their plan anyway speaks volumes about the conditions of their lives as gladiators. Consider for a moment what that decision also says about Crixus and his compatriots. Romans knew their slaves didn't want to be slaves, and the whole framework of the system that enslaved them was designed to avoid a revolt. Positive inducements, freedom, better food, the chance to marry, served as the proverbial carrot dangling from the end of a very literal and painful stick. By 73 BC, the system of subjugation that enslaved men like Crixus and Spartacus had developed weak points they could exploit. How? Why? Was Vatia a particularly brutal master? Did the memory of the massive Sicilian rebellions get passed around between enslaved people in whispers, quietly brewing collective action? Was it the fact that these gladiators were all people who had come from outside polite Roman society, had no ties to its civic structure, and little hope of gaining citizenship? Or was it that they were trained killers who knew how to fight and weren't afraid of death, a potent combination that drove them to take the ultimate step? These were real people, and fear of death and injury are powerful disincentives to action. Those fears were not enough to stop Crixus, Spartacus, and the others from inciting full-fledged rebellion. Crixus seems to have been one of the leaders of the rebel band from the beginning, right alongside Spartacus. More than 200 men planned their escape. Somewhere between 70 and 78 got away from the House of Vatia in 73 BC. They immediately seized a convoy of proper weapons, gladiators' weapons, ironically, bound for another city. Now armed, they headed south toward Mount Vesuvius, about 20 miles away from Capua, where they could set up a temporary community and try to make new lives as free people. Here, their story diverges from most mass escapes. Instead of being felled by the first group of soldiers sent from Capua to apprehend them, Crixus, Spartacus, and the others inflicted a stinging defeat on their pursuers. It would be the first rebel victory of many, the flashpoint of a mass uprising that soon engulfed much of southern Italy. Remember, this was the heartland of mass enslavement in the Roman world. The region was full of latifundia, with their grim barracks and brutal working conditions, which Crixus and the other gladiators would have seen time and again as they went to their next bout. Thousands of the enslaved were inspired enough and desperate enough to risk the same punishment that Crixus and the other gladiators had by setting out, choosing to run away en masse to join the rebels at Vesuvius. There, the swelling rebel army defeated the praetor Gaius Claudius Glaber and a few thousand men sent to apprehend them, further fueling the fires of rebellion. Over the rest of 73 BC, shepherds and drovers from the distant countryside poured into what was becoming a city of the formerly enslaved. Had Crixus ever envisioned such a thing? It was probably around this time that Crixus's vision of the rebellion diverged from that of Spartacus, his more famous colleague. Crixus wanted to directly attack the Roman forces that were stalking them throughout Italy, armies far more daunting than the militia and part-timers they had previously defeated. Spartacus, by contrast, wanted to get the rebels out of Italy entirely and as quickly as possible. After several war victories and plundering portions of southern Italy, Crixus took a large group, perhaps 10,000 people, to Gargano, near the heel of Italy's boot. There, he and his followers ran into a full consular army, roughly 10,000 fully trained and equipped Roman legionaries. After a hard fight, this army cut Crixus and his compatriots to pieces. They died bravely, we're told, but they died nonetheless. Modern accounts tend to contrast Crixus's recklessness with Spartacus's careful planning. I just don't think we have enough information to be able to say that conclusively. It would be more accurate to say that these were poorly equipped people who had little military training aside from whatever Spartacus, Crixus, and the other ex-gladiators and former soldiers among them would have been able to impart in a relatively short amount of time. Their triumph wasn't their victories over Glaber and the others. It was the fact that they escaped slavery on the Latifundia or in the Ludus at all, and lived free for a time before the Romans reclaimed them in death. Spartacus himself wouldn't live to see victory. Like Crixus, he too died in battle, and 6,000 survivors were crucified along the road from Capua to Rome just a year later. But death was still a year away when Spartacus received news of Crixus's defeat. To honor his fellow rebel and mark his funeral celebrations, Spartacus forced 300 Roman prisoners to fight to the death. It's not difficult to imagine what Spartacus was thinking. How many times had Crixus been forced to fight for the benefit and entertainment of others? How much of his own blood had he spilled to please the crowd? How many men had Crixus been forced to kill at the command of a rich sponsor who would never know the grit of the sand or the pain of the lash? To me, this moment, not the final defeat or the mass crucifixion, marks the real beating heart of the rebellion, the real encapsulation of its purpose. In death, Crixus got the exact kind of send-off that he himself had provided in the arena, inverting the very system that had made him who he was. In the end, Crixus died a free man, sword in hand. He was celebrated, honored, and remembered, not as a disposable piece of property fit only to die for the entertainment of the crowd, but as a leader and a warrior. Spartacus's name rings out through the millennia, but there were thousands upon thousands of others who shared his burning desire for freedom. Crixus, not least among them. Next time on Past Lives, we'll continue with our focus on Rome, but move from the gladiatorial school to even more lethal surroundings. An industrial bakery, one of the bleakest places in the Roman world. Thanks so much for joining me, and I look forward to chatting with you again. If you haven't already, please subscribe to our Patreon, linked in the description. It's only $7 a month, and you get access to tons of bonus content, like interviews with great scholars, Q&As with me, our book club, and much more. You can follow me on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick or on Blue Sky at Patrick Wyman. Past Lives is a 100% independent production, and your support is what allows us to make this show. So, thank you. Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. Gabriel Gould provides the music and sound design. The story editor is Rachel Cambori. Until next time, this has been Past Lives.